The place I think I should begin, when Mrs. Blackwood was in the hospital, when Margie was in the hospital in Scotland awaiting the birth of our first son, and that was before the 7 years in the ancient past, Jack, the nurse who was there rapidly found out that she was a Christian. Margie had been talking with her about this, and then she asked her about her husband, and Margie told her about me and that I was a minister, and she said, well, is he the converted kind or the unconverted kind? And having been in the pew for a few years, I was in the pulpit for 7 and then back in the pew, and every once in a while I wished that the man standing in front of me in the pulpit had told me whether he did or did not belong to Jesus Christ, and how he knew whether he did or did not. And at that point, it has become a policy of mine to share with a group of people with whom we desire to come into close contact during the week about how I came to know Jesus Christ. I was born and reared in a home where it was assumed that I was a Christian. My mother died when I was 3 years old, and father had 5 in our family. I was the youngest, and so I was farmed out to his sister. She was a maiden lady, and she was also a school teacher. And this made a very interesting combination for me through my teenage years. And your smiles indicate that the fact was borne out, that is, that there was a very secure pair of apron strings. They were tied very tightly. And then, at the tender age of 17, the war broke out, and I enlisted. One of the things, though, that my aunt had required, and she was a godly woman, was that I memorize Scripture, and one of the chapters that I was required to memorize was the 19th Psalm. And I can remember having to go through this thing before I could go out to play or whatever else it was, among other chapters. And it went then something like this. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day there is speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge, and there is no speech, and so forth. And that's about all it meant at that particular point. But through the Navy, I finally wound up on a carrier in the South Pacific as a navigator. I was responsible, that is, for the safety of the men on board the ship, for the course of the ship itself, and also for the squadron. And in this capacity, it behooved me to know the stars and where they were, and so I had formed the habit of lying out on the bow of the ship at night when we weren't otherwise busy, memorizing stars. And all of a sudden out there one night, the words came back, and I can't explain it, but it became very clear. You know, Blackwood, that makes sense. The heavens do declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. We had a load of Japanese planes on board at that time. We were bringing them back to the United States to get some performance statistics on them, and I had been in the cockpits of the planes, and I couldn't read the Japanese, but I could read their navigational instruments. There is no speech nor language where their voice, referring to the stars, is not heard. Their line, of course, we were dealing with lines of position. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. And it suddenly made sense. I didn't think another thing about God until a number of years later, so far as I can remember now. And I was in college. My undergraduate work was in chemistry. And I was finishing a course in phys chem. It was in my senior year. And I can remember seeing orderliness in the laws of attraction, the valence laws. As I looked down into the atom, I can remember seeing certain laws of attraction there. But the thing that came upon me at this point was, is there a God? Because if there was a God, then Blackwood knew he was going to have to knuckle under. As I saw it then, it would be knuckling under. But if there was no God, then I was free. I'd been under orders for 4 years. I was out for a sort of a temporary stay with the intention of going back into the regular Navy and making that a career. But if there was a God, I knew there had to be some kind of relationship between myself and himself. About that same time, a godly professor in one of the departments there, and I was going through a course in philosophy with him, and he told me the story of one of the old philosophers down who had taught his students this way. He said, if you were marooned on a small island and could see everywhere on the island, and went down to the beach one morning and found just marks in the sand, you wouldn't think a thing of it. But if one morning you went down and found perfect circles drawn at perfect tangents, then you would know that there had been a being of intelligence there. Well, I kept seeing perfect circles in the stars. They were accurate. As accurate as we could measure, and more so. Too accurate to be by accident. My life, as a matter of fact, had hung on those stars over and over again, and so had the lives of the men in our squadron. And they were always accurate and always on time. Our star charts were made after the year 2000 as far as the correction tables were concerned. And so they were going to be accurate. I couldn't get over the accuracy. It made more sense to conclude that there was a God who was controlling these. And then as I looked down into the atom, I saw some of the same accuracy. And to me, this meant there must be a God. Now, at this point, everything that I had heard about Jesus Christ being that God and about his having come down to earth to die on a cross in order to make things right between myself and God, and people didn't have to tell me as a sinner, I could look back over my life and know that while it had been assumed that I was a Christian, the evidence was opposite, and I knew I was not. And everything that I had heard about this Jesus Christ being God and about his dying on the cross for me suddenly fell into place and made sense. It doesn't always for other people, but it did for me at this point. And I knew then that I loved him because of what he had done for me on that cross. And I wanted him to come into my heart, to be my Savior, and to be my Lord. And I asked him to come into my heart. And he did that. And he has been my Lord since then. And he has taken me through many experiences that otherwise there's no accounting for. I wouldn't have gone in the places where I've gone had it not been for his influence in my life. He, I believe, put me in direct contact with the navigators and has taught me things through them that otherwise I couldn't have known. And one of the first men that came down to Bloomington there was a man by the name of Leroy Imes, who took me by the warm hand over onto the campus at Indiana University. And there we met people who became Christians and who kept on growing in the Christian life. And these are things and blessings for which I will finally be thankful when I stand in my Lord's presence in heaven. Now, having told you this about my Lord, I'm just beginning to find out about him. The song that we sang there a little ago, Amazing Grace, and when we've been there 10,000 years or 10 million years, either one, Jack, when we've been there 10 million years, we'll still be just beginning to know about him. But every once in a while, someone gets the idea that we're getting out from under him. I want to talk with you about the way in which I find my Lord meeting the circumstances and situations in the world today as I'm seeing them. And in order to do this, we're going to have to leave the cave of Abdullah here for a little bit and go back out into the world and look around us there. And I'm not giving you any facts that you don't already know here. And yet I want to survey just rapidly the century of change in which we find ourselves, sociologically speaking, for example. We're in the midst of some truly terrifying changes. When Jesus Christ walked on the face of our earth, there were 128 millions of people, perhaps. Around the turn of the century, there were 1,500 millions of people. Today, we have 3,200 millions of people. By the year 6,000, there'll be more than 6.5 billion people. And this makes my head spin. I can't understand this, except that this is the fact. As I go downtown, or as I go out onto the freeway, or onto the highway, in any part of the United States anymore, I find people. And they're pressing in. They're elbowing me on all sides. There are people all around me. I like people. But they're coming closer all the time. And even out in this wide open space in the West, there are people. That we would look forward to the time within six generations when the United States would be a single metropolitan city. This is what our sociologists are telling us, people crowding in. And psychologically, this is having an influence on us. 8 million of people suffering from mental illness. 1 out of every 10 will have some kind of emotional problem. Escapism is one result of this. In an interview with Eric Fromm, McCall's magazine described it this way. Eric Fromm was the one being interviewed. Said people are getting tired of the sense of meaninglessness of life, of the sense that they're little automatons, of the sense that they have nothing to say about their own lives, of trying to save time and then kill it, of trying to be a success and when reaching what they want, with very few exceptions, of feeling, so what? What's been the meaning? I should like to quote the Old Testament, which says they have lacked in joy in the midst of plenty. This was Eric Fromm, a man who's particularly known in the field of psychology, psychiatry. Educationally, it's been a century of change. The more scientists living together today, I am using the word broadly, the word scientist, that is, more scientists living today than ever before on the face of the world. Textbooks. With this explosion in knowledge, we can't keep up with it, and they have to keep revising these things. There are more grade schools and more high schools and more colleges and more universities, more teachers and more students and more teaching aids. And we found another one here just the other day. H.G. Wells saw that better education was the answer to the world's problems. But then, after the atrocities of World War II, he wrote another book called Mind at the End of Its Tether. And C.S. Lewis became very discouraged at this point, and he said, education seems only to make man a more clever devil. Education. Socrates was asked in one of the dialogues whether virtue is acquired by teaching or by practice or by some other means. Is virtue acquired by teaching or by practice or some other means? And Milton struggled with the same problem in his Areopagitica. But regardless of what we may say about it, the fact is that knowledge and education, we've seen some revolutionary changes recently. Scientifically, in the realm of the so-called physical sciences, in transportation, for example, at the beginning of the century, we could go as fast as we could walk or run, or a beast of burden would take us, or the wind would blow us. But then came the steam engine and the gas engine and the jet motor and now the rocket motor. And we're walking around the earth. And I can remember down in the little town of New Concord, Ohio, where I was born and reared, or where I was reared by my aunt, seeing John Glenn roll around the streets of New Concord, Ohio in his little old Chevrolet coupe. And then a few years later, hear of his orbiting the earth. And this is astounding. Communication illustrates the change. The beginning, it was limited to the strength of the voice or the length of the eyesight, the beginning of this century. But today, halfway through the century, our communication satellites have brought it to the point where any man at any point on the face of this earth can be seen and heard by any man at any other point on the face of the earth. Explosive power is another indication of the tremendous rapid change. The atom was designated as the smallest divisible particle at the beginning of my chemistry course. But since then, we've split it and we've fused it, and there are vast new reservoirs of energy that are coming to light through these relationships within the atom. I can remember seeing a picture, I think it was, Bob Hayes would be able to correct me on this, of the old Douglas dive bombers. We used them during the war. And I believe they've re-equipped some of these for use in Vietnam now, and one of these things had greater firepower than the super fortresses of World War II. Explosive power in the world today. Morally, it's a kind of new morality, they call it, and religiously, of course, we're talking about whether or not God is dead, and about situation ethics. Now, all these are indications to us of the world of change. But what's Christ's relationship to these things? Has he been able to keep up with these things? Are we getting out from under him? Is he aware of what all's going on down here on the earth? And I believe that God was dealing with that very subject here in the book that Jack read to us from just a little bit ago, or that Bob did, out of the book of Colossians. The outline of the book in chapter 1, Jesus Christ is being identified in terms not only of his relationship to God, the Father, in terms also of his relationship to the world around him, and then in terms of his relationship to those whom he has redeemed. In chapter 2, our personal relationship to him is very vividly described. How we are baptized with him, how we die with him and are raised with him, how our sins are nailed to the cross with him and blotted out. And then in chapter 3, the results of our personal relationship with him, not only in terms of our own lives, but in terms of our relationship to our wives and husbands, in terms of our children-parent relationships, and in terms of employee-employer relationships. And then in chapter 4, we have some examples of these changes. This is the outline of the book as a whole. But it's in this 16th or 17th verse where Christ is described, and it said that he is before all things, and by him all things consist. And the Greek word is synesketen, that is, in Jesus Christ, all things, the things that we're finding today in the world, sociologically, scientifically, and otherwise, all these things are made to hold together and make sense. This is a flat assertion that these things are not out from under him, but that as a matter of fact, he's in control of all of them. And this is what I'm finding as I go on to find out more about my Lord, and these are things that I want to share with you this morning about my Lord in this century of change. The first feature of his character that I commend to you is his dignity and his majesty, his strength. He has the bearing of a king, a monarch. Long before he was born, in the 45th Psalm, God promised that he would be a royal one. God said it this way in the 45th Psalm, "Thy royal throne, O God, forever shall endure. The scepter, of thy kingdom is a scepter right and pure." The majesty and the dignity of Jesus Christ. It really shouldn't be hard for us out here in this country to think in terms of the majesty and the dignity of the one who has created all this. The heavens, these heavens, declare the glory of God. And this firmament showeth his handiwork. These are the mountains that he piled up. It was by the strength of his fingers that these things were formed. He did this with his own hands. He's one of majesty, he's one of dignity. Before his birth, the angel said to Mary, "He shall be great, and he shall be called the Son of the Highest, and the Lord God shall give unto him the throne." And then the night that he was born, the angels sang for joy. And I suppose that one of the supreme examples of his majesty is one that we very often miss the significance of, there in John, the second chapter, where he created the wine out of water. It was the act, you see, of a creator, the first miracle that he'd done when he came back to earth. If you had been the creator of the world and had been wanting to impress upon the world the fact that you were its creator, and the red carpet had not been thrown out to you, as a matter of fact, they had tried to keep you from being born. And then after you had come into it, the great desire was still there to prove that you were the one who had done the creating. How would you have proven it? And of course, the first thing that he did do was to exercise the same kind of power that he had exercised at the time of his creating of the world. He had made a change of kind. It was water that was changed to wine. It was the act again of a creator, an act of dignity and of power. And Paul tells us that after his death, that he was raised to a position of unparalleled power and authority. Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name. Paul tells us that there in Philippians, the second chapter. And this is an important point today in view of the millions that are crowding in upon us and more crowding in at all times. He gave himself for us? Yes. This is the meaning of those passages through the New Testament where over and over again it says, he had himself purged our sins in Hebrews 1:3. He gave himself a ransom for all in 1 Timothy 2:16. He gave himself for us. The little word himself. It's the dignity of his character that enhances the value of his sacrifice. In 2 Samuel, the 18th chapter and the 3rd verse, the people said to David, David, thou shalt not go forth to battle, for if we flee away, they'll not care for us. Neither if half of us die will they care for us. But now thou art worth 10,000 of us. David was the kind of a general who wanted to be out in front of the people. He was in the thick of the battle. And the people had to ride tight rein on him to put him into the background. And they said, David, stay home. Don't get out in the front lines. If they kill you, it'll be a desperate thing. Thou art worth 10,000 of us. The dignity of the character enhances the value of the sacrifice. And this was not just a man who was dying on yonder cross. This was God, the Creator, the Savior, the Redeemer of the world. This was God who was dying there. And therefore, it doesn't really matter whether there are 3 million or 3 billion or 7 billion. The value of the character enhances the value of the sacrifice. The majesty of the Creator King is involved here. The second feature of my Lord's character that I commend to you in these circumstances in our 20th century is his near relationship with us. Sometimes when we look at these mountains and these rocks, we begin to think that we're sort of alien, that we're having to fight against these. This is the way some people see them, as though these things were meant to be obstacles, and others see them as though they were meant to be friends. I had a very good friend, old Dr. James R. Witherow, who was head of the Department of Chemical Engineering at Ohio State for many years. He was a graduate student of geology and had studied all over the world in connection with some of the oil companies and the finding of oil reserves. And he used to speak about how God had put signposts in the soil, the way in which the rock strata were arranged, the way in which the fossils were put there. And these were not put there to betray men or to misguide them, but to guide men to those valuable resources which God had hidden for men's benefit beneath the surface of the soil. And he spoke of how what a wonderful God we had, who would guide us to these valuable things. Sometimes when we look at the great things that God has done, or His majesty, we begin to think of ourselves as being so small. And we need to remember again that it's also this near relationship that's important. And long before He was born, the angel promised that it would be of the seed of the woman. And then the night that He was born, of course, we saw that it was the same kind of blood and the same kind of flesh that we have. The same kind that He has, we have. He was born of man. He was among men there in a manger. And we saw Him grow tired as we tire. And we saw Him become hungry with our hunger. And He hurt with our pain, and He laughed with our joy, and He cried with our tears. He identified with us at every point. In Hebrews 2:16, for verily He took not upon Him the form of an angel, but the seed of Abraham, the flesh and blood of our own. And he, of course, was telling us about this himself that day over in Luke, the 10th chapter, where he described the Good Samaritan. He was that man, and he was telling us about himself there. The Good Samaritan who was coming down toward Jerusalem, well, it would have been the Jew who was coming down to begin with, and he'd been waylaid and robbed and beaten, and then the Good Samaritan came down. And the priest went round him, and then the Levite went round him. But then came the Good Samaritan, and he got down and bound up his wounds and tied up whatever needed to be tied up, and took him over to the hotel and took him in and told the hotel keeper to take care of him that night. And then when he left the next morning, he said, and if he owes any more, I'll pay that too. And Jesus was describing the story of his life. He told that story of his coming down from heaven in the face of some severe opposition and criticism. The scribes and Pharisees had been criticizing him on that particular occasion, and finally he turned from them and he said to the people, you know what this situation reminds me of? It reminds me of the Good Samaritan. And I think we could see the people sort of nudging one another and saying, well, he certainly knows those scribes and Pharisees, doesn't he? He knows they really don't care for us.
They're professionals, but they really don't care for us. He knows us, and he understands us. And he's identified, he's purposely chosen to identify himself with us. He loves us. Jesus Christ was describing his own life as he left heaven to come down to earth to bind up our wounds there by the side of the road, our wounds of sin. He was telling us about himself, identifying with us at that particular point. And Dr. Tweedy, in his book on Logos Therapy, said, "This is the answer for the lonely, tormented minds of today. The Christ who will identify with us. In the midst of thousands of people pressing in on all sides, the Christ who will identify with us closer than any other person on the face of this earth." Christ's personal dignity and his majesty in the midst of this rush and bustle in our 20th century world, Christ's near relationship, this close personal love that he has, and third, the third feature of my Lord's character that I commend to you is his wisdom and his knowledge. Christ is truth, and he knows all the truth that there is, speaking of this knowledge explosion. Solomon was his Old Testament type, and Christ said, "I am the truth." And Paul told Timothy that he was the only true God, the only wise God. Beyond this, he proved himself wise. He was the master of all the wisdom and all the learning and all the education of that day. They addressed him consistently as Rabbi. A lawyer friend once told me that there are three kinds of knowledge essential if we're going to deal with men as men on the face of this earth. We must know man, the man with whom we're working. We must know the standards of conduct that are involved, the law that's been broken in the case of a lawyer and his client. And we must know the judge before whom the case is going to be pleaded. And Jesus Christ knows all three of these things insofar as the human race is concerned. He knows men. In John, the second chapter, in the 25th verse, we're getting down to the point of where Jesus is beginning to identify and let this knowledge of men be made known. And Jesus, it says of him there that he needeth not that any man should testify of man, for he knew what was in man. It's a very interesting set of circumstances there. Because in the second chapter, we're told that the disciples had believed on him. But then at the very end of the second chapter, we're told that there were others who came to believe on him because of the miracles which he did. But Jesus would not commit himself unto them because he knew all men. In other words, he committed himself to some, but not to others. He made a distinction. He saw that some believed on him because of the miracles which he did and others because of who he was. Some saw him as being God. Others saw him as being a miracle worker. And he knew the difference. He understood that one was a false belief and the other was a genuine faith. He understood the difference. And he illustrated that difference in the very next chapter, in the third chapter. Here came one called Nicodemus. And he was a man who said, "Lord, I believe in you. You're a tremendous teacher." And Jesus said, "That's nice of you to think of me as a great teacher, Nicodemus. But don't you see anything out there?" And Nicodemus said, "Well, what?" And he said, "Well, except you can be born again, Nicodemus, you're going to have to be born all over. Nicodemus, I see that you're trusting in your relationship to Father Abraham to get you through. It's your family relationship, the physical relationship that you're trusting in. And Nicodemus, I'm sorry, but you're just going to have to be born all over again. You're going to have to trust in me as being God, not just a great teacher." And whether he did or not, we don't know. But we find one example after another of these places where Jesus knew men. He understood them. Nathanael's another example of this. He looked up that day when Nathanael had been gotten and Philip had gone back to get him. Philip said, we found the Messiah. We found God. He's the one that's been promised. And Nathanael said, "Go away. Nothing good ever came out of Nazareth." And Philip said, "Well, why don't you come and see for yourself?" And so he did. He was honest at this point. He came to see for himself. And Jesus saw him coming down the aisle and he said, "Now there is an Israelite in whom there's no guile. He's not a double-minded man. He's single-minded." And then it was Nathanael's turn and he said, "Well, how did you know me, Jesus? Are you trying to butter me up?"
he was honest. He said, "How did you know me?" And Jesus said, "Well, I saw you. How did I know you? I saw you when you were under the fig tree before Philip even called you." And I don't know what he'd been doing under the fig tree, but whatever he'd been doing, he knew that Jesus knew, and he knew that he knew he knew. And there was a communication that went between the two of them, and he says, "Well," he's not a double-minded man, he's single-minded.
And then it was Nathanael's turn, and he said, "Well, how did you know me, Jesus? Are you trying to butter me up?"
He was honest. He said, "How did you know me?" And Jesus said, "Well, I saw you. How did I know you? I saw you when you were under the fig tree before Philip even called you." And I don't know what he'd been doing under the fig tree, but whatever he'd been doing, he knew that Jesus knew, and he knew that he knew he knew. And there was a communication that went between the two of them, and he says, "Well, do you know that? You're the one. Thou art the King." And then it was Jesus' turn. He came right back at him, and he said, "Are you going to believe me on the basis of this little bit of evidence? Stick around, man, and thou shalt see greater things than these. Thou shalt see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. I'll really prove myself to you if you stick around." This is the one thing that many people won't do. They won't come to Jesus and ask, as Nathanael did there, and ask that he would prove himself to them. Jesus knew men. He knows us better than we know ourselves. He knows us backwards and forwards. He knows men. He knows the law that's involved. It was his finger that wrote that in the stone on the top of Mount Sinai there. He was the author of those commandments. He lived those commandments. He taught those commandments. He died in order to pay the penalty for those commandments. And then he offered to relive those commandments in us, his life in us. He understands the law that's involved, and he knows the judge. He said, "I and my Father are one." He knows the judge, the one who's trying the case. The fourth feature of my Lord's character that I'd like to commend to you is his power. And here again, Christ's power is more than a match for the powers that have been discovered, the powers that control their powers. He stands behind all of them. And this power is essential to his character because, you see, he may have dignity to adorn and show us that which he is by the works of his fingers. He may have this near relationship by which he can identify with us. He may have wisdom and power, a wisdom and knowledge, the wisdom to know how to project the knowledge and his understanding of us. But if he doesn't have power to execute, it's of no use. He has that power. "All power," he said, "is given unto me," in Matthew 28:18. And the next time you're quoting that verse for a missionary who's going out, make sure they understand that. This is his word of comfort. "All power is given unto me, so go. You don't need to be afraid of what's going to happen to you there. All power is given unto me, so go." And again he said in Matthew 11:27, "All things are delivered unto me of my Father." And in Acts 10:36, Peter said of him in that sermon there, "He is Lord of all." There's nothing that he's not in command of. And in Ephesians 1:22, Paul was trying to describe this thing, and he said, "God hath put all things under his feet and made him to be head over all things to the church." Didn't say the church was head over all things. Made him to be head over all things to the church. And then in Hebrews 2:6-8, it says, "In that he put all things under him, he left nothing that is not put under him." This always reminds me a little bit of the housewife who's been sweeping everything, and she's gathered up everything that she swept, but then in case there's anything left, she lifts up the corner of the carpet and sweeps it under and then puts the carpet down. This is just a sort of a catch-all for anything that might be left there. "In that he put all things under him, he left nothing that is not put under him." All power, all things, all flesh, even the unredeemed, are under his power. Unredeemed? Yes, surely. He must be able to protect his own people against those who do not belong to it. The power in the atom, the power in the field of transportation, the power in the field of communication, these things are not out from under him. As a matter of fact, he's in control of him, of all of them. In him, all these things are made to hold together and have sense. In him, all things consist.
And these powers that we're discovering to get today neither baffle him nor frustrate his purposes. All power is given unto him. The fifth feature of my Lord's character that I'd like to commend to you is his high moral excellence. And this is a counterpart to the so-called new morality today. Isaiah said, he had done no violence, neither was there any deceit in his mouth. And the angel described him to Mary there that evening as being that holy thing. And Christ himself said, I do always those things which please the Father. Which of you convinceth me of any sin? And they never did convince him of any sin. They never did convict him. Pilate, four times there, said, I find no crime in him. Pilate was the most objective evaluator on the spot at that time. If it had been one of the Jews, we'd have said either he'd been a friend or he'd have been a foe. But the Roman, who was trained in Roman law, according to the standards of Roman justice, four times they took Jesus in there before him, and four times he came back out and he wrung his hands and he said, but I find no crime in him. He couldn't find anything wrong. Someone said 17 million minutes of sinless life lived in the midst of a sinful world. And he died, and yet at every point in the scriptures where it describes why he died, we're told that he died for sin. He had no sin of his own, and yet in both the Old and the New Testament it says that he died for sin. And if not his own sin, then whose? If he did die for sin, and this book says so over and over again, and yet he did not die for his own sins, for he had none of his own, then for whose sin did he die? Yours and mine. Aye. Yours and mine. His high moral excellence. And this is the answer to the sin in the world today. The sixth feature of my Lord's character that I'd commend to you, his meek compassion, his tender mercy, his munificent bounty. These are all three one and the same. You see, he might have dignity, he might have wisdom, he might have power, he might have integrity, but all these could be seen as being harsh and vindicative and almost repulsive. He's so good and perfect and big and great and wonderful, and I'm so much me. And so opposite, so different. But Christ combines all these other things along with his compassion and love. And how our lonely, weary, tense, and love-starved world needs this particular part of Christ today. The way he spent time with the woman at the well there. And she said, but thou, a Jew, askest drink of me, being a Samaritan? The Jews and the Samaritans don't have any dealings together. He said, yeah, I want to drink the water out of your cup. There was a written law to the effect that no Jew was allowed to drink out of a cup that a Samaritan drank out of. He said, I'd like to have a drink out of your cup. And she said, tell me more. What kind of a man are you? And he said, well, I can tell you more about myself. Why don't you go get your husband? She said, I don't have any. He said, I know you. I know you very well. I know everything there is to know about you. I know you've had seven. The one you're living with now is not your own. And she said, Lord, where can we worship? Where can I worship? And she wasn't changing that subject. She knew that the sin that Jesus had identified was coming between herself and God, and she couldn't worship. And the Samaritan said, you've got to get rid of your sin down here in Samaria. And the Jew said, you've got to do it up here in Jerusalem. The Samaritan said, the only place you can kill animals and do it is down here in Samaria. And they're still killing animals there in Samaria today to do that. We saw them. And in Jerusalem, they said, the only place is up here. And she says, I don't know where to get rid of it. And he said, it's not where, woman, it's whom. And I that speak unto thee am he. I'll get rid of your sin for you. I'll take it away. And she came to believe on him there then. She accepted him, and she asked him to take away her sin. And then she went right back into town. And she said to the folks in there, "I want you to come and see a man that told me all things that ever I did." And she used her own life as a bait. And they came to find the same takeaway of sin that she had found. And did. And there was a time with the children there, and he was busy, and it was long towards the end of his life, and the children were bothering, and they said, "Now shush the children." He said, No. "You suffer those little children to come unto me, and forbid them not. Their problems are as big as yours. They're a little smaller. You think yours are big. Theirs are as big as yours are. I have time for them." And the day he hung on the cross and looked down there and saw his mother and the sins of the world on his shoulders, and what time then would he have for her? But he did. "Woman, behold thy son. Son, behold thy mother." He had that kind of compassion and love, and he wept for Mary and Martha. It would have been so easy, you know, for you and me. We knew what we were going to do. We were going to bring Lazarus back to life again in a few minutes. We were going to bring him right out of that tomb. And we would have said, "Oh, now just take it easy for a minute and we'll fix it all up," the minute we saw them crying. But we're told that Jesus wept. And the Greek words that are involved there mean he literally exploded with grief. He went right, in spite of the fact that he knew how he was going to correct the situation, he went right down to the very bottom of their depth of their sorrow and grief to identify with them in this. This was the kind of compassion he didn't override. He never does. The last feature of my Lord's character that I commend to you in this century of change especially is his authority, the right that he has to exercise the powers and to transfer, as it were, these features of his character to us. It's one thing to have power. It's another thing to have the right to use that power. And this word authority is the thing that we're dealing with here. In John 1:12, we read this, "As many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name." As many as received him. This involves our opening the door of our hearts and asking Jesus Christ to come in, to bring his life into our lives. As a matter of fact, to take our life and put his in its stead. To put these same features of his character into our life. Somehow or other, we become so busy and so tied up with the people in the world and the powers in the world and the trends and the emotions and the circumstances and the businesses and the social relationships in the world that we don't have time for this one. I may be speaking to someone here this morning who has not actually asked Jesus Christ into his heart or into her heart. And if that's true, then I'd encourage you to go ahead and ask him in. On the basis, the same basis that Nathaniel first came to Jesus. "Lord, prove yourself to me if you are Lord." And I know that my Lord can do that for anyone who will ask him into the heart and into the life. And I know, too, that he's more than a match for any of the circumstances in life, the 20th century of change. Any of these circumstances, he's more than a match for them. His character, his life, is more than that match. Let's bow our hearts in a word of prayer.